As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday, on The Athletic Podcast Network.
On today's episode of Nerd or She Wrote, we're going to dive into Seth Partnow's tears. And we're going to talk with John Hollinger about his article on the All-Hero team.
This is Nerd or She Wrote with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Welcome to a new episode of Nerd or She Wrote. As you know by now, I'm not Dave Dufour. Dave is out finding himself in the forest, in the woods, trying to be one with nature. But I have Seth Partnow with me. Seth, would it be kind of funny if Dave comes back with a full head of hair?
I would worry.
I would be shocked. It would be really weird. I'd be very curious what wilderness Dave looks like.
I would immediately go to that same wilderness if he does come back with a full head of hair. I can guarantee you that.
Dave will have found the fountain of youth, hopefully, by next week.
And fountain of fur.
There'll be no more baldness. Fountain of fur, there we go. There's many weird ways we can go there. We're going to leave that one alone. Seth, I'm going to leave it for you here. You've come out with not a rankings. Don't call it a rankings. I believe I tweeted that out and got yelled at. But you've done some tiers, some NBA tiers, where you've dropped all week long, 5 through 1. Seth, take the floor.
So it's obviously very important to know what you have on your team. And that is sort of the starting point from this is now is the point where we've just finished the NBA finals and we're heading into the offseason with the draft scheduled and free agency coming some point after that to be determined. To come up with your plan for what to do with the offseason, you need to know what you have. And you need some sort of scale to recognize how close your team is to where you want to go. And from what I've found from past research and really based on stuff, really some groundbreaking research Kevin Pelton did when they were doing like the all-time NBA rank project, is that there's a certain level of kind of player goodness at which players kind of start to matter. And it's not like guys below that don't matter. You need, you know, good, competent minutes to get you to the playoffs and then deep enough into the playoffs to win. But the guys who really move the needle, it turns out to be about 125 guys, give or take, every year. And the higher you go up that, the more each player matters. And each group matters more by a bigger difference than the last. So the jump from tier 5 to tier 4 is one thing. The jump from tier 4, which is players 40 through 80, give or take, to tier 3, which is the 20 to 25 to 40. That's a bigger jump, and then a bigger jump still from players about, you know, 5 to 20, which is tier 2. And then the really top guys are your true superstars. And then being really kind of hard-eyed about who goes where. Because if there's one thing, and I'm sure John can agree with this, if there's one thing that is not in short supply in basketball circles, it's optimism about, you know, just how good, especially your own players are.
Yeah. And I think, John, I want to throw it to you. Actually, this is the first time the three of us have been on a podcast. We've all been with NBA teams. John, like, this is a project that you would feel you would do yourself in Memphis, right? or along these lines, maybe not these tiers, but.
Yeah. I mean, we all were looking at different ways of how to rate and rank players and come up with kind of valuations for, you know, especially ahead of free agency, kind of determinations of what is this guy worth? And more importantly, what is this guy worth to our particular team and our particular situation? So we spent a lot of time in Memphis, not so much looking at point guards and centers, but everything in between because of that. Whereas other teams in other situations, I think, would kind of look at different situations or different types of players more heavily. When we had, and again, this goes to not just kind of a straight valuation, but kind of within these tiers, you're sort of picking out which players are best for your situation, right? When we already had Tony Allen, we weren't going to go hardcore after another guy who played the wing and wasn't a shooter, for instance. And I think every team is sitting down and making judgments like this as they map out what their free agency, what their offseason is going to look like.
I mean, I've had so many conversations of, would you want this guy over this guy? You know, or, you know, from my days in the video room, just kind of wandering into, you know, somebody's front office exec's office and having conversations of just random stuff. And we would go through of like, how many guys would we want before we get to one of our guys, or the other way around, and things like that, and having that debate and things like that. I thought that was kind of really interesting, Seth, in your pieces, and John kind of just touched on it. Like, you know, if you're Memphis and you have Mike Conley, you're not looking at other point guards. He's your guy, right? You're focused on other positions. And I think you kind of touched on sort of how teams look at fit and things like that.
I do think that even if you're set at a position, though, you do need to know kind of where you stand, because I think that is we've got our guy. Is he a franchise superstar in this league, or is he an all-star in this league? And that, and kind of figuring those things out really do tell you, are we one player away or are we two or three guys away? And that kind of affects how you manage your cap and kind of what moves you kind of anticipate making. I mean, if you're one player away, then, you know, a slight overpay for the guy who you think is going to put you over the top makes a lot more sense than it does if you're nowhere. So even though you're not like, you know, you're not, it's not like the meme of the guy looking at the other woman, not his girlfriend, with when you have Mike Conley, you do have to know kind of where he is in sort of the spectrum of the top point guards in the league, just to give you, just to help give yourself a sense of how close are we?
And it is so much harder evaluating your own players because you're both more favorable and more harsh at the same time. Like, usually on your young guys, you're kind of very generous and you're thinking, because it's your guy that you picked, right? So it's like, oh, of course he's going to develop into a starter in 2 years. And you know, when someone's like, well, he's kind of similar to this other guy who's rates as the 423rd best player in the league. And you're like, shut up, man.
It's almost,
what are you doing with this
data? It's almost like, and you need a red team. You almost need somebody that's completely outside the organization to come in and slap you and be like, you know.
That's it exactly. Yeah, yeah. And on the other side of it, you'll turn around and ask the coaches by the end of the season, and like, by that point, they hate everybody, right? Because they're so sick of these guys, even the best players. They, you know, they all have weaknesses. They all have their, you know, little hang-ups or weirdnesses or whatever. And so it's completely the opposite situation.
Yeah, I mean, so like, how do you take that in, though, John and Seth, you too? Like, how do you guys take that from the coaches when you're looking at it, or from the video guy who comes in and says, hey, you know, I'm not sure about this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the assessments from the video guys, I think sometimes are pretty sharp when it comes to other teams, because they see so much of these other teams when they're doing the preps. The coaches, not so much. The coaches, I found, actually are the opposite situation, where they really only see the other team the four times they play them, And then otherwise, they're still kind of, they're mentally like 2 or 3 years ago when it comes to a lot of these players on other teams, it seems like. So that was an interesting thing that I didn't really grasp until I got into the league. And
yes, video guys are better. So, video guys are always better.
In this particular situation, they kind of were. And then obviously, you know, we had our own scouts and people and whatnot who had their own opinion. We had them sort of like during the course of the year looking at questions like this, you know, who are the players in other teams who are maybe undervalued by their own team, you know, who could be available? What do we think of these guys? How do they compare to the guys on our team, et cetera?
Yeah, and that's the thing that I hope gets across in this is not like a static list that exists at all periods and times. It's a snapshot, and it's a never-ending kind of process where you, no matter how formally or informally you kind of do this rating, ranking, tiering, however you're going to do it, it's you're constantly reevaluating over the course of the season, and it's sort of the push and pull is not wanting to be behind, but also not wanting to overreact to one or two good games. And, you know, especially from, you know, this is sort of the input you get from the coaching side is a player has a great game against you. You really have to push back a little bit against that. Well, he's the greatest player in the league. He just put 40 on us.
We call that the Doc Rivers.
It definitely wasn't only Doc Rivers, yeah. I'll tell you that.
No, it wasn't, but it's just fun to do that one.
And then on the other hand, if you want to move somebody, you know, go quickly, pull up who his career high was against, call that team first.
Right.
Every time.
Works perfectly. But it's perfect, like, when you talk about it in terms of trades, because Seth's right. This is sort of a evolving list that you're kind of working on throughout the year. And, you know, as you're leading up to like the trade deadline, how do you guys play into the rankings and stuff? Seth talked about it. I've personally seen it. I imagine I'm curious what John's board looked like, but you know, you have the, somebody has the front office board where they're ranking everything and, you know, whatever it's magnets or whatnot. That's what it was with the Clippers, you know, of, you know, this guy, this salary, you know, we like him over this guy or whatnot. How does that kind of play into kind of, you know, the trade deadline, because it's something you're working on, I imagine, throughout the year.
I think that's a part where it's a different process depending on where you are as a team. I think the better a team you are, the more you're looking at kind of specific fit. Whereas if you're in a more building phase, you're trying to acquire talent efficiently. And those aren't mutually exclusive, but you're probably leaning more towards one or the other, depending on again, where you are as a team.
Yeah. I feel like our trade deadlines were so constrained by possibilities that it was really, we didn't spend a lot of time ranking players ahead of the trade deadline. We spent a lot of time discussing what was possible and then discussing the subset of players that were actually attainable.
Yeah.
And how they would work with us. So we kind of came at it a little backwards, because I mean, for most of my time there, we knew who the four main players in our team were, and so you're trying to backfill around that.
Yeah. So I do think that you get in a situation where it really helps to have done the work on what you broadly think of kind of players around the rest of the league before you get into that decision time, because the bias towards action, you can easily kind of talk yourself up on a guy if you haven't really really vetted it thoroughly, like through your process, whatever it is. You know, this guy's available and we need to make a move, so let's make this move, when it maybe doesn't actually make sense if you
took that step. Never happened. <Yeah.
laughs> wait. I'm thinking of a name. There are two other players who share the same last name on this list. Am I wrong?
Let me think about that one.
Danny and the mainstay and the death lineup.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But like, you know, it's fun because this is the kind of like your rankings and your tiering of guys And again, kind of coming back to the fit thing, like this is something when we were with the Clippers, we would, and when I say internal discussions, mostly in the video room, which meant nobody gave a damn what was being said. but like we would just sit there, and this is, we have a young Blake Griffin. We have Kevin, you know, Kevin Love in Minnesota's killing. This is like 2012, 2013. And we're kind of sitting there going, you know, well, who would you rather have? And that's sort of the fit question, you know, for us. I was like, I thought Blake was the better player, but in terms of fit with Chris Paul and DeAndre Jordan, I said, oh, well, yeah, Kevin Love would probably do really well here because he'd be helped to spread the floor. It's his, while Blake was working on his shot, Kevin already had one. And you know, you have the same amount of passing, I felt like, maybe even better passing from Love and all that stuff. But this is the kind of debates that, you know, leads up to it. And this is sort of the what you guys are trying to accomplish, or what Seth was trying to accomplish with his tiers, right? Or am I way off base, Drew?
No, I think you're right. And the important part isn't the end product. It's that discussion that you're thinking of, because it really helps you. You're going towards this end product of, okay, we have this list up on the board, but it's also, you've had to think at a very granular level about your team and other players around the league. And I think that's like doing it in that way is, it really sharpens your kind of understanding and instincts of what's out there. What do you need? What do you have to spare? Which allows you to be kind of more freeform creative in like the expand the possibilities of moves you can make just by having a fuller understanding of all that stuff.
Mo, you're not going to be happy when I tell you this. Kevin Love killed us.
Oh, no, I mean,
prime Kevin Love freaking wrecked us.
I mean, there's not, like I said, John, nobody gives a damn what the video guy thinks.
Yeah. It's hard too. I mean, as a franchise, I mean, when you draft that guy number one overall and he's, you know, Lob City and all this and the face of the team or whatever. And what's funny is by the time he got to the end of his Clipper tenure, the beginning of his Detroit tenure, he was skilled enough on the perimeter to do a lot of those Kevin Love things and hurt us the same ways. He just wasn't at the time you needed him to be that guy in 2013.
Well, that was always my fundamental problem with the Lob City Clippers, was just those guys, and DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin, just weren't the guys we needed them to be. They just weren't. They needed more time to be there. And in that, it's, you just said it all the way. And that's why I'd always say, like, well, you know, Kevin Love's probably not ultimately the better player in the deal, but he would have raised our ceiling. Now, listen, this was never a trade that was actually on the table or anything like that or discussed. Again, a lot of dumb things get said in the video room. And you can probably chalk this one up to me being smart and everybody else being dumb for once. But
of course.
You know, but this was a common thing. But this is kind of what I look at when I look at your tiers, you know, and you know, I thought you did a great job with your tiers. If, you know, I can nitpick and say where I think some guy should be versus another guy. But for the most part, I felt like the tiers themselves were pretty well put together.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, I mean, I know there's some guys that I am, you know, since this ultimately came down to my judgment after doing, you know, some work with metrics and canvassing a wide range of opinions, this is ultimately like, it's easier in a way in that it's mostly my judgment. And it's not something that had to be really arrived at via committee, which is, you know, again, to do this in a formal way can take weeks or months. But yeah, but it does, again, makes you understand why you think of a guy in a certain way. And I you said something really interesting there, Mo, which I think is another reason why this exercise is so important, is what do we need this guy to be good? And it's very easy, and John, I think you'll agree with this, it's very easy for you to say, okay, well, for us to reach our potential, this guy has to be the 10th best player in the league. So let's just assume he's the 10th best player in the league.
Right.
And you know, and being really strict and in your judgment about and realistic about, you know, where guys, you know, are relative to other people. Is it close enough that it doesn't matter? Or really, okay, actually, no, like Paul George is a step up from
Donovan Mitchell or something like that. Okay, we recognize that and act accordingly. Interestingly, one of the players who ended up much higher on this list than he would have probably prior to the playoffs is Jamal Murray. And it seemed like the Nuggets were operating as if he already was, because they needed him to be for, you know, having already given him the extension and stuff right. like that. And it seems like it's going to work out for them, but it doesn't, either you can say they saw something before the rest of us did, or they got lucky, or somewhere in between.
Yeah, it actually works perfectly to go right into John's all-hero team, you know, because Jamal Murray.
I wrote about Jamal Murray today. Exactly. Yeah.
So, Jamal Murray is, it's interesting because I think everybody had the same reaction you had, John, when he signed the extension. Everybody was like, are you sure you want to give him this?
Seemed like a reach. Right. Yeah, the 5-year max, right? Yeah. And now you look at it and you say, you're a small market like Denver. You go to the max to lock the guy up for 5 years instead of 4. And maybe that was a smart thing to do now, because it looks like he's going to be basically worth it.
My main issue was it wasn't the fact of it. It was the fact they did it before the season rather than after it, which, you know, it's you lose that little bit of, you take that little bit of risk on the team side and that little bit of extra information that you would get over that season. If he had ended up with like signing that deal after the season, sure. But I also agree with you, John, that it's kind of thing that on the other end, having him, you know, emerge as this player as he did in the bubble, now looks pretty smart to have him locked up long term.
But like for John, what changed your opinion of Murray? Like, what did he do over the course of since he signed that contract where you're like, all right, that's justified? We know he blew up in the bubble, but like, what were some of the skills stuff like? Because I always felt like he could score.
Just the fact, I mean, he just did it more consistently. Like he would have individual games where he blew up, but then, you know, then he'd have 7-4 in his next two or something. And like, it's just, he just brought it so much more consistently in the playoffs under a huge minutes load too, actually. And then I thought his accuracy as a shooter, and maybe that's a short-term fluke, but I mean, he played 19 playoff games. Like, it's kind of a long thing to just say, "Well, that was a fluke," right? And so I think there was that. It's weird. I think he had the space to be more assertive offensively, maybe because of their other injuries, not having Will Barton there, not having some of the other guys they were missing early on with the COVID stuff, and Millsap being a little bit less than what he was. Like, in some ways, I think that gave him the space to just be like, okay, I'm just letting it rip now.
I think it probably got almost goosed a little bit by Utah kind of was clearly trying to make Jokic be a scorer
right.
instead of a playmaker. And that put more of the playmaking burden on Murray. And mm-hmm. and then it seemed like he realized and they realized collectively that, oh yeah, he can do that too. He's not just a bucket getter. He's a guy who can facilitate and get for other people at a high level too. And that was, I think that was the maybe the more easily sustainable part of his bubble growth, if you will. But on the other hand, you mentioned the shooting. And even if it regresses some, it's still especially kind of from a pull-up shooting standpoint, he has a lot of room to regress to still be better than what his kind of bar was before that. And that was really one of the things that was holding him back from that kind of tier of you know, maybe like the Kemba Walker-ish, like lead scoring guard kind of thing.
I have a question for you guys, but I'm going to ask it after this break.
I'm Trey Wingo. And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers? That's a butterfly effect for
real. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And we're back, fellas. So here's my question to you. How much does the bubble and the seeding games and the playoffs kind of make these rankings so difficult? John, you addressed it in your Hero Team article. Seth, you addressed it in your rankings. You know, like, how are we supposed to evaluate these guys? It was just such a weird situation. I mean, the shooting was crazy in the bubble. Is that something that we feel can continue? All that fun stuff that we've talked about for, 12 weeks it feels like now.
Yeah, I think it just makes Seth's rankings completely wrong. But mine are fine.
I said that from the beginning.
Yeah.
I've said, as soon as Seth told me he's doing rankings, I just yelled out wrong.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. That's good.
That's the favorite way to invalidate any methodologies. I disagree with this guy's rank, so the whole thing was dumb.
The entire thing. Yes.
Anyway.
I have a player ranked 124th that did not make your top 125. Ergo.
And I'm offended. I shall fight you to the death.
Yeah. I think we talked about this. Was it last week when we had Ben Taylor on? We talked about this a little bit with him in that some of the guys, especially the young guys who John mentioned in his Hero Ball piece, were probably, we saw their development after what would have been a normal off season of work. And that first off season is probably most important for the younger guys because you get your first sort of trial by fire. It's like, oh, I need to get better at this. Okay, I could get away with this before. Now at this level of play, I can't. So let me work on this. Now, whether we see kind of what would be a second full offseason of improvement before next season, whenever it starts, I don't know. My impression is probably less likely just because kind of the normal open gym cycle that we're used to where guys are getting, early September, guys would start showing up back at the gym and start playing pickup games, right, and stuff like that. That whole cycle has been broken, so I'm not sure we'll see that, but maybe. And as far as just the overall like shooting and play and how much the lack of travel played into that, we just have to take a wait and see approach to see how real Jamal Murray's shooting is, Anthony Davis's shooting is. Tyler Herro's overall play. I don't want to. I'm very reticent to go out on a limb and say either way because there's kind of factors that are pulling in either direction, and it's we're completely off the map in terms of what to expect next.
And it's funny because we talked about this a little yesterday, Seth, but I talked to some people in the league on the same subject, and I basically got the same answer, which is that we're in uncharted territory, and it's almost something you take case by case and say, okay, well, why was this guy good or terrible in the bubble, and how much of that do we think is predictive versus not? And it just makes the overall evaluation process a little more challenging heading into the off season.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that scares me in terms of free agency. We have Jeremy Grant, who's going to be a free agent in Denver, and they're going to probably pay a bunch to sign him, and there's going to be teams that are interested in him. How much of it was just being in the bubble and being able to perform like that, or is that something of like, no, this is who he is? Like, it's a hard god it's yeah. just such an uncomfortable thing to kind of figure out. Like, at least when you had a normal season, you're like, all right, we can figure how all this kind of plays together and how it works. But with it, in terms of just the free agents, for me are the bigger issue than,
yeah,
listen, Jamal Murray's signed, he's They made that commitment to him a few years ago. So they were screwed if he sucks. You know, Tyler Hero is going to be with the Heat for the next few years. It's the guys that they got to make decisions on, you know, whenever free agency is going to start.
Yeah. Jay Crowder, Goran Dragic, Rajon Rondo, Kentavious right. Caldwell-Pope, right? Yeah.
Like, those are the guys.
So I think that and I think that the guys who had a good playoff run, good bubble and playoff run, that's closer to something that we normally deal with in, you know, we've seen guys have a nice playoff run and get like stupid contracts before. You know, the OG of this is Jerome James, of course, but yes. You know, in more recent years, like Solomon Hill had a good right. little run in the playoffs and got like an eight figure annual contract out of it. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, that's still something that has to be navigated, but it's of a piece with sort of the normal kind of evaluation there. The more interesting and harder one is guys who were, you know, bad. What do you think of like, you know, there's obviously extenuating circumstances for Montrezl Harrell.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But at the same time, some of his weaknesses are weaknesses you might have expected to see from him in a playoff setting. So how do you balance the benefit of the doubt factor versus if he was going to struggle, that's how he was going to struggle.
Yeah, well, I mean, was Paul Millsap, you know, was he bad because he's getting old, or was he bad because it was just a contrived situation and Denver had a lot of moving pieces and it's just not a great environment for him?
Yeah, it's tough. Like with the Montrezl Harrell piece, Seth, I actually think this is who he is. You know, I get the circumstances he had and kind of never really was in great shape, but I think you're right on. And I think this would have been problems for them in the playoffs. This is why I had been screaming all year that they needed to get another legitimate big man. You know, the Paul Millsap stuff, John, to me is interesting because it's like, that's the big one. Is it just he's old, or is he old and just didn't really handle the bubble well? Like, there's just so many guys I felt like the bubble was too difficult for him.
Yeah. And then there was the other argument that's been made that some of the guys benefited by, let's say, the limited nightlife options in the bubble.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. We didn't get to see JR play much, but I'm sure he would have been great. You know, or another guy who, he's not a free agent or anything, but like Westbrook's a great guy who was rolling in March, you know, February and March was his most efficient.
Yeah.
You know, he comes into the bubble, comes back from COVID, has a quad injury, and, you know, really kind of stunk it up. For me, my problem with Westbrook wasn't just whether he could physically do it. It was just, I thought his decision-making was terrible, which I don't feel like either of those players roll into it.
I mean, for a guy his game is based a lot on just like nuclear athleticism. You start to strip that away and then plays, I can make that play. And now, no, wait, I'm not fast enough to do that. Even though and how much of that is him getting a little bit older and versus, you know, not being in tip top shape or a little injured because of, you know, the COVID and injury situation. But as you said, I mean, he was, you know, he played possibly the two best months of his career, heading into the shutdown. So what do we make of Russell Westbrook? I like, he's one of the harder guys to evaluate. And then on top of that, it's, you know, how damaging to Houston long-term is, not just from a contractual standpoint, but from a style of play standpoint, is building in such a way to maximize Westbrook. I think that's almost the bigger problem.
And that's when you get into these upper tiers, it's really interesting because there are some players that they're great, but you have to do so much to sort of assemble a team around them that fits and works that it's not as conducive in some ways to winning at the highest levels as it is with the classic archetype of like the small forward who can dribble and pass and shoot, right? Where you can put anything around them and it works, right? And whereas, you know, a Joel Embiid type, he can dominate games, but you have to you have to put more structure around that to really make it work.
The other thing that gets hard too, though, like in Westbrook's case, it's, you know, as he's aging and him falling out of the tier, you know, these top tiers, you're beginning to, he doesn't see it that way. He's not on the same page as the front office going like, yes, I'm getting older. Yes, my skills are diminishing. Yes, I suck now. That's not exactly what he said, but you know, it's hard.
The Carmelo issue all over again, right?
Yeah. You start kind of running into this whole thing of how do you kind of get these veteran guys to deal with the fact of like, yo, you're getting older. You're not as efficient as you used to be.
The Sean Marion, Vince Carter, aging gracefully is much more the exception than the rule.
They're the unicorns.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And even those guys, there was probably a year or two in there where it was pretty rough for them. And they just realized it a lot more quickly, I think.
But still managed to be, you know, effective, valuable players, even as kind of their capabilities and roles started to shrink. I mean, you know, Marion was obviously a big part of Dallas's championship. So, John, you touched on something, and I want to see if you agree with me on this. Is as I was especially moving into the top tiers, That's when I started to really put a premium on kind of high level offense creation, however you want to say it. And it is kind of embodied by that kind of do everything small forward. And that's both because I think that skill is valuable, but also a little bit what you were kind of alluding to is from a team building perspective. It's easier to find the guys to go around, you know, Jason Tatum than it will be to find the guys to go around Rudy Gobert. Once you've paid, assuming each of those guys are kind of on a max-ish contract, like once you've established that, it seems like you can find 90% of Gobert much easier than you can find 90% of Tatum. Is that, would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, you still kind of have to go out and get your max perimeter player to make it work. Even once you have your Gobert or your Embiid, or even your, I mean, Jokic is a little different because he plays almost as a point center. But even with him, you could see where there are situations where, and you saw it in the Portland series a year ago too, where you need perimeter shot creation beyond just your center dribbling it up and throwing some crazy pass. So from that sense, yeah, I mean, that perimeter shot creator, I think, is where it all starts for teams now. And it's one of the things, I think teams have still been a little slow on this, like when it comes to the draft, like at the top of the draft, like, why are you drafting centers? Like, what are we doing here? Right?
Right. Well, I find it interesting just because I think teams now are hopefully beginning to realize you kind of need to have multiple ball handlers on the court. I think that's something, you know, that was one of the big things for the Lakers with Rondo and playing him with LeBron. He was able to create a couple easy looks for LeBron in that situation. He was able to enter the ball into the post for him. But just kind of having another guy. Now, Rondo's probably not a guy you're going to worry about pulling up and shooting, but having multiple ball handlers, multiple guys that could kind of play make at the same time sort of just opens up and maximizes everybody else on the court, right?
Yeah, I mean, we saw it with Toronto the year before, right? I mean, certainly we saw it with Golden State and the Splash Brothers.
We saw the reverse of it this year with Philly. Like, imagine how different if you just replace like Shake Milton with Rondo on Philly in the playoffs this year. Like, is that a more competitive series just because, you know, Rondo is able to, you know, feed Embiid in good post-up position with much more kind of consistency than any of Philadelphia's perimeter guys were able to. I don't think they win that series with Simmons out, but I think it's less desultory if you have a little bit of that.
You weren't on the Shake Milton is going to fix everything bandwagon there.
I like Shake Milton, but I'm just like that's a specific, like, that's one specific skill that, like, to kind of to John's point, that sort of all around, like almost like a ball moving central midfielder, mm-hmm. who just isn't going to, you know, score the goal or make the killer pass himself, but is just going to keep things moving so everyone else can play.
Yeah. I find that to just be intensely valuable. And I don't know if I'm hoping more and more teams are going to see that. I mean, hopefully Philly will see it and start trying to figure out how to get actual ball handlers on their team to help feed those guys. Anybody got anything else before we bounce? Is there anything we need to touch on here before we call it?
I just want to reiterate, no matter which of the 30 teams you're a fan of, I hate your team.
Hates your team. I just hates your player and hates you.
I just think it was great for Seth to come up with these end all and be all rankings in order from 1 to 125.
That will stand the test of time forever. Yes. This is how it is for the next 30 years, folks. This is the ranking tiers, whatever the hell you want to call it, Seth. This is what we're going with. And John, your all hero team. This is what we're sticking with.
And yeah, these are the only 9 good players in the league.
Period. And also, you got to go read John's piece just for the great TLC comment. That's all I'm going to tease there for that. For John Hollinger, for Seth Partnow, for super producer Andrew Schleck, and me, Mo Dekeel, I think we're done, and hopefully next week we'll have a furry Dave.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.